The Guardian.
Hi, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis, and coming up in this programme...
Tell you what, let me widen the question out. Favourite popular figure?
Churchill.
Wow, what is it you like about him?
I love the way he says, "Ah, yes." Ah, yes.
The IT Crowd's Douglas Wrenham. Comedian Matt Berry tells us all about his psychedelic concept album. We call the indie professor into the podcast to answer your alt-rock posers. And in Singles Club, we've got tracks by Group Love, Fixers and Gil Scott-Heron. That's all coming up in Music Weekly. Hello and welcome to the programme. Rosie Swash is still away, so her immediate superior on guardian.co.uk/music, Tim Jones, is here. Hello, Tim.
Hello. Very much appreciate that insertion of immediate superior.
Absolutely.
Took a lot of bargaining to get that in.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, you can pay me later. and he's brought in with him a proper intellectual, someone whose PhD at UCLA involved her touring the UK with bands, working for labels, and even babysitting Bonnie Prince Billy. The latter in particular is dedication. Here is theguardian.co.uk/music blogs, indie professor Wendy Fonero. Hello, Wendy.
Hello, good morning.
You are going to be answering some questions the listeners and readers have sent in later. Before we get to that, let's just talk a little bit about you for the benefit of anybody who doesn't know what you're about. When did all this studying start? When did you become the professor of indie rock?
Well, I started my field work in 1993, but I would think that it started probably when I started going to shows, which was when I was an undergraduate in San Diego, mm-hmm. and worked at a college radio station that specialized in British music, right. unlike most other American stations. And initially, music was just my way of escaping academia. Mm-hmm. But when I was doing my PhD at UCLA in anthropology, I had gotten very interested in rituals. And I was at a show and all of a sudden had this epiphany moment where I realized I was at a ritual event and mm-hmm. that this was a good way to pursue a lot of the things that I was interested in understanding about culture and ritual and what functions they serve for society.
Wow.
So for me, indie music is really a case study of a much broader question. So
you do stuff other than music. Now, your most recent question on the music blog was about why gigs are so loud. What was the answer to that one?
So I had my own ideas about why they were so loud, mm-hmm. but I went to several of my engineer friends and then also talked to a few other crew people because you don't want to just get the engineer's point of view.
Sure, sure.
But there was pretty much agreement amongst everyone that the dynamics of small stages and microphones and basically the fact that everyone wants to be loud in the band, and that it's
sort of an ego thing.
Yeah, there is an ego thing.
Mm-hmm. It's not like bands to have egos, is it?
It's quite, amazing, quite isn't it?
Everyone wants their instrument heard, and
sure.
and it starts where you have the guitar has a very loud amp, and at the same time, drums are very loud to begin with, and the sound man sees it as his or sound woman sees it as their job to make it so that you can hear the vocals mm-hmm. and. That creates this sort of escalation of all parts to constantly try and get that vocal range, which is in the same range of
right,
sound
okay.
as the guitar, mm-hmm. clear and hearable by the audience. But then again, there's a certain age where people start thinking gigs are too loud. Mm. When you're young, you don't think they're too loud. And
no.
you really enjoy the visceral experience of physically feeling the vibrations of the music.
Do you ever worry about demystifying music?
It's funny you say that because in one of my sections in my book, I start out with a discussion by a person in film who talks about what does it mean to demystify cinema and how it does take away the magic. And so that's almost my warning. If you read this, you'll understand why people say don't meet your
sure.
heroes.
Sure.
But it hasn't ruined it for me. I think it does for a lot of people. But for me to see that...
You're spoiling it for everybody.
Well, the other thing is that for people who still sort of believe the magic show, I think you can tell them what's going on and they really won't believe you.
Absolutely. So
I think it's only ruined if you want it to be or if finding out the truth somehow makes it less. For me, it makes it more interesting.
Well, look, we're going to have some listener questions later on, so keep listening. But we begin today's programme with something a little bit different. Matt Berry, who you'll probably know as Douglas Renholm in Channel 4's The It Crowd, or if you've got an even longer memory, he wrote and starred in BBC Three's brilliant Snuffbox.
Hello there. You must be Quick Finch's granddaughter. You're much better looking than he is. They look heavy. Let me take these to your table.
Thank you, handsome. The gin and tonic's for my sister, Ruth.
Okay.
This one is for Stacey.
Hello.
And if you could hand this one to my boyfriend.
Fuck you. Whiskey?
That's a Snuffbox, a sort of slightly long-lost piece of Matt Berry's work. However, he's made an album. It's called Witch Hazel. It was originally released as a free download in 2009. It features him playing nearly every instrument and having written and recorded it himself as well. It's now going to be officially released by Acid Jazz, of all people, in March. It's really, really good. I was enormously sort of surprised by it. So when he came in earlier, I asked him how he got started in music.
You know, I was kind of doing music first, to be honest. The acting thing was the accident. I get really bored just doing, you know, one kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was in, you know, I was in sort of various bands through sort of college and stuff, and, you know, have always, you know, kind of made music. Most of the stuff that I've done, you know, sort of my own stuff has been kind of comedy based.
Because you wrote a rock opera at one
I did,
point,
yeah.
Didn't you? Yeah. Yeah, sort of Jesus Christ Superstar parody, yeah.
Yeah. That was shown once. They got a bit kind of worried, I think. They thought it was, you know, an irreligious piece.
Sort of Jerry Springer the opera. Kind
it
of.
Wasn't that bad, you know what I mean? It was, you know, it had, you know, kind of Mary in it, and that's always a bit of a problem with something.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, I interrupted your flow. You were saying you've done a lot of music.
Yeah, you know, and did this for no reason, this Witch Hazel album, and, you know, sort of took it to Acid Jazz, and then that was it.
So when did you record it? How long ago did you record it?
A year ago, uh-huh. In my flat.
Really? It's totally recorded at home?
Yeah.
It's got a big sound for an album that was recorded at home.
Well, you just got to know where to stick the mics. That's all.
It's got a very, very distinctive style. Late psychedelia, edging into prog kind of thing, sort of 1968-ish.
That's exactly vibe. It. Would you like to look in my eyes? Would you like to look in my book? Could you give me money for this? Would you like to look in my eyes? Would you like to look in my book? Could you give me shekels for this? Would you like to look in my book?
What were the kind of artists that influenced you? What were the kind of artists?
Well, the kind of countryside sort of atmosphere of folk, like, you know, the kind of Mike Oldfield. The first kind of three albums, for sure. You know, the rest of it, I'm not at all interested in. But, you know, the first three kind of have that atmosphere. You know, as does Kate Bush, in a way. And it's that, you know, was in my head, you know, I guess, while I was doing it.
I think one of the things that's interesting about that sort of late psychedelia, early prog, or even Mike Oldfield, an album like Hergest Ridge, is there's a sense of humour in it. And, you know, it's something that's kind of difficult in music these days. It's frequently seen that if you sort of make jokes on records, then the whole thing is a joke. You know, yeah. If something's meant to be funny, and that didn't seem to be the case then. You seemed to be perfectly able to make kind of...
Well, I'll tell you why. It's because I don't care about those, you know, those kind of, is your foot in this camp, you know, or is it in that camp? I'm just going to do stuff.
Songs bleed into each other. Is it a concept album?
Yeah.
What's the concept?
Well, it's
because, like all concept albums, I didn't get what the concept was from listening to
no,
it.
No, so. Sure, well, it's very subtle. It's sort of the horrors of the countryside. It goes from somebody killing someone by accident at a harvest festival to magic mushrooms, you know, all kinds of things. I came in my gun just to try. Just basically things that would scare me, you know, in the countryside.
So different aspects that would scare you rather than sort of public information film kind of thing. Right, yeah. right. The track with Paul McCartney on it is fantastic.
No, thanks. Why do all you animals go to extremes when you could be living?
example to us human beings and stop behaving like Japanese.
Well, he wasn't the first. He wasn't actually the first choice. He was. He was fourth on the list,
right.
And the first three people couldn't do it, and he could. You know, so he's on it.
It's very big of him to take part in an adventure that was just recorded in your bedroom.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's only on the last 30 seconds of the track, but, you know, he's good on it, I think.
We all know how to love, make love. I know
he's offering a very impassioned plea. I think that's the main thing, for a bit of unity and peace and love. You play live a lot. You've been taking it out. Is it a difficult thing to reproduce this stuff live? Because it is quite the sort of choral arrangements and things like that.
I mean, it would be, but I'm with a bunch of jazzers, and they love it. You know,
really?
I mean? Yeah, because it's ridiculous. Don't you think?
What? Because it's rock music, and all rock music is ridiculous.
And, there's kind of lots of, you know, strange kind of changes in it and stuff. You know, that they don't normally play. So they love it.
What kind of people to see you live?
To be fair, most people know that it's a sort of music show, and you get five people that think it's going to be stand-up. So what I try to do is keep the kind of talking to, you know, an absolute, you know, sort of minimum, and just, you know, kind of get on with it, so there isn't any kind of misconception.
Yeah.
So if you think, well, what the hell's this? I thought the guy was going to, like crack some jokes. And then when that doesn't happen, they can go if they want.
Do you plan to take this further? Is it something? I mean, what are your sort of future plans?
I'm in the middle of sorting out the next one.
Right. What are your plans for that? Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't know. I've got an idea at the moment that it would be music for insomniacs.
Right.
It would be like a functional album, which you would play last thing at night.
Like the sort of original concept of ambient music in a way, which is sort of very functional, wasn't it?
Yeah, because I kind of got the idea because, you know, you have these kind of favourite albums that you listen to last thing, you know. Mm. I mean, I do. I think, you know,
definitely, yeah.
And I thought, you know, if I make something, you know, for that kind of purpose, but put a bit of a sting in it in different places,
yeah,
I want it to be startling at times, I think.
It's quite an intense state to listen to music in. I always find that sort of just slightly between awake and sleeping.
It is if you kind of fall asleep during that 45 minutes and then, you know, kind of wake up at the end of the album, because you lose all sense of time, you know, sort of obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you think you've heard things, you know, in different orders, and it's just all
absolutely
kind of crazy.
So it's music to fall asleep to that may potentially give you nightmares.
Or steer you to do certain things, maybe.
Oh, really? Like subliminally?
I don't know, yeah. It depends, you know, how kind of dangerous all that is. I am quite interested
quite
in
dangerous,
it.
Quite dangerous, I would have
thought. Yeah. It is kind of interesting, you know, because you've got them captive there.
Mm.
And if I can get people in bed and still, then I've done my job.
So that's Matt Berry discussing his debut album, Witch Hazel, out in March on Acid Jazz. Tim, what do you make of that? I mean, it's an interesting idea that he's made an album that has jokes on it. He's known as a comic actor. But the album clearly isn't meant to be a joke. This is a problem that plagued The Darkness, who I hasten to add, it sounds nothing like. But they were a band that, you know, I mean, had enormous difficulty in convincing the public that though their music was meant to be funny, they were not a joke band, they were not a novelty act. Is it something you can pull off, do you think?
I think it's very, very, very difficult. But I think when I heard that he'd done this project, I was kind of, you know, instantly dismissive of it. But then when I saw the cover, I was quite swayed instantly, just because it's kind of like a, would you say, a mid-lake aesthetic going on?
Kind of, yeah.
And it just straight away looks like he's taking it seriously. And you imagine his face as a comedy actor, but when you see it on the cover, he's kind of got a bit hairier.
He looks like he could be in a band. That's very true. Yeah.
So I think instantly I was quite swayed. And then when I heard it, I just thought, actually, yeah. I think if you can pull it off, if you do pull it off, then you're okay. But it's very, very, very hard to do. But that's because it's very, very hard to be a good musician.
Absolutely, yeah. I really think, you know, I urge you as listeners to check it out. Right, time for Singles Club now. A flick through some tracks we love at the moment, and we're going to kick it off with Wendy's Choice. Naked Kids by Group Love. Wendy's Choice. Wendy, I confess to total ignorance of either Group Love or Naked Kids. Tell me a little bit about the band and why you brought that in.
Well, they're a local band from LA. Mm-hmm. They're about to do a month-long residency at a club in LA called The Bootleg. And one of the things that's been making so much great music come out of Los Angeles is there are all these clubs on the east side of Los Angeles that do free nights on Monday nights, and now it's even expanded to Tuesday nights.
Okay.
And all of these bands that would not normally be able to get big crowds, people come out because it's free. And this is one of the bands from that scene.
Okay.
And Best Coast.
Yeah, sure.
There's so many bands that have gotten their start that way. And this is a band that's about to come and tour in the UK as well. But I like that it's got that really warm, summery California Beach Boys vibe. I have to say that I thought your choices that's coming is interesting, that there's so many interconnections. But I'm a big sucker for hand claps.
Sure.
And in some ways, really, when it comes for me hearing music, it's a rather instantaneous thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I heard in my car, and then I wanted to sing along with it in the car. And I usually don't like music that has lyrics that are quite so literal.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, one of the things that I liked about it to bring here is that it sort of reads differently in different countries.
Okay.
I think in the UK that it really presents that California idyllic that's often looked at almost like a class thing. But
sure.
In Los Angeles, the idea of driving to the beach in a convertible, you're instantly envisioning a beat up old car, mm-hmm. that it's seen as something that's really very young and teenage and not affluent at all.
Interesting.
It's escapist. And here it's so foreign and exotic. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can understand how this record would sound marvelous if you were driving to the beach in LA in a convertible beat up or otherwise. Looking out of the window at York Way in the January drizzle, transport you there?
I probably wouldn't, you know, whack it on the stereo if I was driving through Nuneaton or something. But I know. I mean, I heard it and straight away thought, you know, this is as West Coast as you can imagine, really, music getting like...
I thought it sounded like Pavement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I mean, that's just me.
I found in a way it didn't thrill me that much, actually. I found it a little bit kind of superficial, I guess. But it did have that thing of making you nostalgic, I guess, for a life that you've never lived. In the same way as, like, say, you might listen to the Pogues and think, you know...
I wish I was drunk and Irish.
Yeah, yeah. and it also, it's very teenage, isn't it, the song? And it kind of...
Yes, it is.
It reminded me of a lot of videos where, you know, homemade videos, which I think you might have done with this very song, actually, Wendy, where, you know, people will put a collage of, like, footage they've shot or their own videos, and it sounds like the perfect kind of thing to, you know, soundtrack it and stick it on YouTube.
Is it coming out over here? Do we know? I mean, is it sort of...
I think it's being released on January 25th. Okay. And then I know that they're going
to
be here in
they're
the UK in February.
Man, so. That's they've got their work cut out for them, creating those Californian beach vibes in the UK in February, let me tell you.
Well, people want to escape during February.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. That's great. Naked Kids by Group Love coming over at tour. Check them out if you dug it. Okay, let's move on. Here's my selection.
No.
That was Gil Scott Heron's I'll Take Care of You, remixed by Jamie XX, who has, Jamie of the XX, I suppose you should say, who has remixed his entire album from last year, I'm New Here. I really like that. The other track that I've heard, I've only heard two tracks off that album, and the other track that I heard was very sort of dark and intense and bleak in its remix. This, I really loved. It had this kind of summery, old-fashioned house music kind of vibe, but it seems to be taking place at a weird distance. The sort of reverb on it makes it sound like it's something happening slightly far away. It's something slightly intangible about it. I just really, really liked it. I think Jamie XX is sort of on fire at the moment. He seems to be doing loads of good remixes, and he did a mix on Radio 1, which you can find on the internet. It's a half-hour DJ mix. I urge you to check it out. Wendy?
It's very interesting because last night I went to Rough Trade Records and I was talking to Stephen from Rough Trade. Mm-hmm. And on their wall, they had their top 10 albums of 2010, yep. And at number two is Gil Scott Heron. Mm-hmm. And so I started asking him about it, and he had told me that that album was put forward as Best New Artist.
Yes, it was. Yes. Was that at the Brits?
Yeah, it was at the
Amazing.
Brits.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Which I found, so I asked him, how could that possibly be? Because, I mean, for as long as I can remember, I've always heard that name, and enough so that finally last year I was like, how come I've never heard any music from this man? It's interesting. I can't really quite hear in that why he's thought of as the godfather
sure.
for rap.
It was quite a bit of a change of direction, wasn't it, really, this album?
There's more singing on it, I think. If you heard something like The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Are you sure you never heard The Revolution Will Not Be Televised by Gil Scott Heron?
No, right. After I looked it up, I'm like, oh, he's the one who did that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, it seems like a big departure. And for me, that sounds, I hate using this word, but it sounds really pleasant. But for me, pleasant is not a bad thing.
Sure. Tim, do you think it's pleasant?
I wouldn't like to use the word pleasant, actually. But
about Gil Scott Heron?
About what, in general?
Well, I mean, I'm sure he's a pleasant man, but I mean, you know, he's not really had a pleasant life.
I love this version, I have to say. I liked how it took the pianos from the original, which was a very downbeat song, and
sure.
gave them a piano house kind of makeover. Mm-hmm. So it was great. I love, you know, the juxtaposition of that and his kind of grizzled soul voice. But what it really, really reminded me of is Richie Havens' track, you know, Going Back to My
Yes,
Roots.
Yes, of course.
Which is, you know, one of the best songs
absolutely.
Ever. So, I liked it because it reminded me of that. But I think, you know, Jamie XX is a very exciting prospect for this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've found out the other day he's working with Drake on Drake's new album.
Is he really?
Which I think could be very interesting because Drake, I absolutely love Drake.
Right.
But I think, you know, his music verges very closely on the could be absolutely awful.
Yes, absolutely.
Kind of and I think if he kind of teams up with someone like Jamie from the XX, you could end up with quite an exciting prospect.
Finally on Singles Club, Tim's choice. Yes, a star down the running. Break your heart. Fixers and Iron Deer Dream, Tim's choice. Tell me about Fixers, tell me about Iron Deer Dream, tell me why you like it.
Well, Fixers are part of the new kind of Oxford scene
that
people are talking about. And
who's talking about the new Oxford scene?
Well, unlike most scenes where a journalist labels them and all the bands spend their kind of career trying to distance themselves from it, they've actually, a lot of bands from Oxford have kind of called themselves this blessing force, and they're basically a kind of a collective of bands who help each other out. It reminds me of like the Northeast scene when the Futureheads came around and all their bands have put on shows for each other.
Yes,
they're very DIY.
Yes.
So lots of gigs in people's lounges and you know, that kind of thing. The bands, I don't know if you know, Chad Valley, Trophy Wife, Pet Moon, Solid Gold Dragons, all the big
guns. Big names.
But I think they've all come through kind of Foles, other band that has kind of titled.
The sort of gateway act.
Yeah,
other
yeah.
Things. Okay, okay.
So that's where Fixers come from. This song is coming out on Young and Lost, who we spoke to last year.
Indeed, we did.
Girls from Young and Lost.
Oh, those two posh girls.
Two very nice girls.
They were lovely ladies, but they were quite... I mean, I don't want to get into the whole posh in music argument on here, but they did seem quite...
Yes, they're
very well spoken and well brought up young ladies, and there's nothing wrong with that.
They started their label from boarding school.
Anywho,
what I got from this was Animal Collective. It's quite interesting that bands are taking Animal Collective and making it quite commercial, I guess.
Yes, that's very interesting.
Turning that kind of East Coast avant-garde pop into
pop.
Oxfordshire avant-garde pop. But you know what I mean? I think there's quite a commercial sound to this.
It's a very commercial sound,
And but it actually ends with the piano line from God Only Knows.
Yeah.
Right at the end. It just suddenly stops and you just hear that.
Which keys into what you were saying, Wendy, about the sort of West Coast influence and the connections between. Mm-hmm. What did you feel were the connections between this track and your choice?
Well, it sounds so much like the Beach Boys. I mean, I hear so much more of that than Animal Collective in it. And I absolutely love this track. Last night when we got back very late from the pub, we were listening to it. I was with a group of guys, and we were able to find this other one where it's just the singer with a Casio.
Yeah, I've seen that on YouTube.
And it's absolutely stunning. At the end of the day, the lyrics are influenced by, you can tell Van Dyke Parks all over it, which is, they sound like they're saying something really relevant, but at the end of the day, they're unfathomable. So it does several unpredictable things. Like in the middle, it seems like the song is over and then it comes back in again. And then at the end, it does this coda of God Only Knows. So I'm definitely going to see them live the first chance I have.
The only note of caution I would strike about this band and their music is that I hope they keep that kind of quirkiness about them and the kind of, all the things that you've mentioned and those kind of influences. Because you turn it 45 degrees in another direction and you could be looking at the sort of band that would really get on your nerves, I think, after, you know what I mean? I don't mean keen, but do you know what I mean?
Right.
Kind of commercial indie rock, kind of mainstream indie rock thing that people will get on people's nerves after a while. However, that doesn't get on my nerves at all. I think that's a really great single. Well done you. Universally liked opinions about Fixers. Keep an eye open for them. Before we move on, some thoughts from last week's podcast blog. Punk Anderson said, "It scares me how much in agreement I am about the returns to form of the Decemberists and the Go Team. Don't be scared. Don't be scared, Punk Anderson. Picaresque was excellent. The Hazards of Love was absolute torture, and On the Bus Mall is a gem." On the Bus Mall is such a beautiful song. "The new album is much, much better than Hazards of Love." Yes, it is. Absolutely. "Dave Portivo was in agreement with Michael Hann on Hazards of Love. Particularly enjoyed my magical rendition of Deep Blue Something's Breakfast at Tiffany's. But had this to say about the other two singles club choices. I thought Adele sounded post-Marling, as in what Marling popularised on I Speak Because I Can, not invented, as it were. Ever since seeing Brothers promo pictures, I've done everything possible to avoid listening to them. More painful than my ears could stand. Oh, wow! He's sort of live blogging it here. Jude just said what I was typing. Amazing. End of message. And all the way from Brazil, Roy Silva, I don't quite know how to pronounce it. What the hell of a job you've been doing lately at Guardian. Last week, we humble natives of Brazil weren't able to download that important Film Weekly's last edition. And now this very edition of Music Weekly, brackets Go Team, follows the same steps. Merely 15 seconds are allowed to be downloaded. I hope it's 15 seconds of me. I hope it's 15 good seconds. What's going on in the estate of John Cleese land? Will we ever be redeemed? We will investigate. Somebody will be fired. Heads will roll. By the way, if you are listening outside of the UK, stick a comment on the blog and tell us where you are. The programme might be taking a foreign trip this year. Really? Really? Clearly, I've not been invited. And we'd like to know where you're listening to us from. And then we won't go there. You can leave comments on that and anything else in this week's programme at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Okay, as we promised earlier in the show, Wendy, our indie professor, is here to answer the questions about music that have been puzzling you. We're not talking about Trivial Pursuit style, what was the first number one of the 1970s questions, if you hadn't worked that out already. This is more about the music industry. Tim.
Yes, I sourced these on the Guardian Music's Twitter.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So let's start with a question from Victoria. How indie is a band, Wendy, if it's signed to Mercury Records? A lot of people are always interested to know about indie and what it means, but how indie is a band if it's signed to Mercury?
Well, as far it would depend on what definition of indie you want to use. Most people have this idea that indie means indie label, and really the only it was only in 2009 that that was an official industry definition. Before that, it just meant independent distribution. And that meant whatever the nature of ownership of label, you could be considered as part of the indie charts if you had independent distribution. Now, that's not the case anymore. So that means technically, if you're going to use a chart or an official industry definition, Mercury would no longer apply. But if you want to use one of the different definitions of indie, something like an aesthetic, then it really doesn't matter what label you're on. If you want to use it as an attitude, well, then the label you're on makes a difference. The idea that you're supposed to be doing it yourself, not having the support of a corporate structure, those would be things that would make a band that's on a major label not be. But if you're talking about a band itself, does that mean if you were once on an independent label and then get signed at a major, that suddenly the nature of your being has changed? So it ends up being, what sort of definition do you want to use? And at the end of the day, I always look at what are the things that people are arguing about to say if you're in or not in to define what indie is. So those points of contestation are really important. So I would say at the end of the day, for certain purists, the label is the be-all, end-all. But I always want to know, why do you care more about label and then you don't care about publishing company? Because really, seriously, bands only get their income from publishing. I mean, people talk about them getting money from being on the road and on from merchandising. And that's just naive. I mean, you don't make money on the road unless you're those giant acts that are doing stadiums. And most of the bands we're talking about would abhor playing at O2 or something, maybe. So that would be my answer for that.
There you go, Victoria.
I used to totally stop liking bands when they signed to major labels when I was a teenager. Absolutely true.
Even the Buzzcocks?
Well, I'm not. How old do you think I am? Buzzcocks had split up by the time I was a teenager. Thank you very much. You won't be coming back. Right. No, seriously, I didn't buy Nevermind by Nirvana when it came out because they'd left Sub Pop and therefore were no longer worthy of my consideration. Brilliant. Adam Fickett, presumably this is the Adam Fickett.
Yeah, yeah.
The Adam Fickett of Baby Shambles fame. Says, how many gigs have you paid to get into?
A lot. I think for my first decade of going to shows, I paid for all the shows I went to, which at that point I already knew a lot of people in the music industry. And eventually people were noticing I was never asking to get into places. But then I went through this period where I was extremely skint. I mean, I had no money and I wanted to go to shows. And I discovered a way in the States that you can get into shows for free. And it's something that wouldn't work in the UK because of the whole horrible system of touts here. But all you'd need to do is stand by the guest list line. You get there at doors. Right. And as people walk up, you say to everyone who comes up, do you have an extra plus one? And it would, within 15 minutes, you would get into a show for free. Yes. And people have often claimed, oh, maybe that's because I'm female. But my very short, squat male assistant.
Eagle.
Lovely, lovely, genial person. I told him to do this. And he's like, it's magic. It works every time. But eventually, I think there's something in that there's something suspicious about people getting into shows for free. Mm. And I think it's sort of naive to not understand that there is a whole other system of commerce that goes on with bands. And it's even something that you're really talking about in that Oxford scene, which is an informal system of reciprocity, which is that if you are giving people gifts, and gifts can be recommending them, helping them get shows, telling other people about other people. I mean, there was a time that someone called me up and said, do you know a drummer? And I got I got their drummer the gig. Things like that means that, you know, they feel that I already feel like I've gotten a gift, but if I really like a band, I feel indebted, so that I feel like I need to give some sort of gift back. And then by giving a gift, that's reciprocated. And what you'll find is that then next time people come to town, they'll be they'll be calling you in advance and saying, please come to the show.
I have to say, Adam got very angry while in the process of asking that question.
Why?
I think it seems to be, there seemed to be almost like a thought that if you don't pay to go to every show, then you're not for real or something. Which
I wonder how many shows Adam's
got. Well, I was going to say, you know, I mean, surely as a professional musician, you realise that once you've kind of made it to some extent, then that's something that just happens rather than... But I think, do you feel like you get a lot because you're billed as the indie professor? A lot of people think, oh, how dare you become a professor of indie? What have you done? You haven't... And then you can hit them back and say, actually, I'm a professor of anthropology and I've gone to thousands of shows. And
I found actually when I first started doing my research, there was more hostility. I think that a lot of people find something illegitimate about studying this form of culture, which I think is really weird, because if you do think that this is important and relevant, why shouldn't this be something worthy of study? I mean, should it only be classical music or areas of culture that we designate as high art? Should it only be from other societies? I mean, in my book, I said that if I was studying Balinese shadow theater, no one would have any question about that. And yet this is something that so many more people are passionate about, and I think it makes it a more valid area of study. But as time's gone on and I've done more things for people, I find I'm invited to things more, and I'm challenged less on, you know, why are you here? And actually, occasionally, I'll be asked to go on a tour, and people go, who is she? And they say, well, she's our anthropologist.
So. Not every band can say that. So Amy Haar's got a question. He or she wants to know, will there ever be an indie angst? I think that means, will there be ever kind of a war between bands like there was in the 90s between Oasis and Blur? I guess what the question is, you know, why are people fascinated by these battles between Blur and Oasis, or bands slagging each other off? Why do people like that?
Well, I think it's part of a broader discourse of debate where we like to turn everything into a reductionist argument, so that it's the way that our politics are run, it's the way that science is run, and so you'll find that reproduced also in music. It's almost always using warfare idioms, so that you can't really solve problems as much as just reproduce this idea that I'm on one side and you're on the other side and we're going to argue with each other. I always think debate is really... almost like I'm sorry, everyone who's involved in this, a really worthless field, because what they tell you to do is argue against something that you believe.
Oh, I see. You mean like debate, like school debate,
like school debate,
a debate that we have around this table, right? I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
it's like the idea of it being like the Blur Oasis debate.
Yeah,
the grand debate they had that time in the 90s.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Well, right. Or it's like the fact that why you had to be on one side or the other. Why can't you like both bands, or even just dislike? And it's interesting, it's less common for that pitting against each other to be done by bands as it is by with female artists. Almost always when you have female artists, you'll be asked these questions like, you know, who's better? I can't remember. I think Esquire.
Debbie Gibson and Tiffany.
Yeah,
they had a
exactly.
Big war,
Back in the day, there was like Madonna versus Cyndi Lauper.
Cyndi Lauper, yes, of course.
But why?
Recently, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, Little Boots, how do you think you're going to make it when LaRue's around and all of that?
Which
is quite, you know, there's enough indie bands around, like male indie bands, and no one's asking them.
It's really interesting, that, isn't it? Why do they want to do that, do you think?
Well, it's that idea of, again, a warfare model. And that sort of, Deborah Tannen has written about this and her article is called Fighting for Our Lives. Mm-hmm. And she talks about that this idea is it's a way to win, but not actually accomplish anything.
Okay.
And that might be, it provides great entertainment. I mean, if you think about television programs, if you have an expert come in on something, let's say on HIV, they'll bring someone in who, whether or not they're qualified to argue against that point. So it creates great drama. And so in music, it isn't really that harmful because, after all, it is a spectacle of entertainment. But when you're talking about serious matters like politics, to be seen as weak if you actually change your mind or weak if you want to compromise, it's a big problem. I always ask my students to go and join debate. and at that point where they think that the other side has really made a good point, say, you know what, I think they're right, I'm going to go and join their team.
It's an interesting thing, though, that you say, because if you think about in terms of being a music fan, certainly in terms of being a rock critic, if you are seen to have changed your mind about something, which people do all the time, that's seen as a real sign of weakness. I mean, despite the fact that, I mean, famously Lester Bangs, the sort of guy who's held up as the god of all rock critics, would totally change his mind about records to the degree where he'd review them again and say completely the opposite thing that he'd said about them in the first place. It's really intriguing.
And it's one of the reasons why so many people have respect for him. Mm. But at the time, people will criticize you.
Got one more? Got time for one more?
Yeah, but before we get on to the next question, I'd just like to I've been thinking about this. I don't want to keep harping back to the point you made about the Buzzcocks. I'd just like to say that when the Buzzcocks signed to a major label, I was 6 years old. Like, I just worked that out. 1977, the Buzzcocks signed to EMI.
Well, wait, then if we're going to ask that, do you think Nirvana's stuff after they signed to Geffen wasn't as good?
No. Do I think? Honest, I think Nirvana's absolute, for me, Nirvana's absolute peak is that single Sliver.
It's my favourite.
It's my favourite Nirvana song. I had it on the other day. Just brilliant record. So on one level I do, but do I think their integrity was compromised now? No, I was like 18 and full of shit when I thought that. So, you know, that's fair enough. Final question from Jay Aylward asks, how is she just so goddamn indie? How are you so indie?
I honestly don't think I'm that indie, but I feel sort of like an outsider in some ways, in part because when I was getting into this music in the States, it was not popular. Even the underground scene in the U.S. was totally different. It was called college music or underground or alternative. History's now being rewritten to call that what was going on then indie. And I was constantly being told that the music I liked didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So most of the people I knew who I was friends with from other domains of life, all of them said, oh, no, this music, there's nothing different there. There is no UK scene. Mm-hmm. So I was always sort of, yeah, really? I know, seriously.
It's baffling, okay.
Yeah, I was told constantly that indie didn't exist. And I think it's interesting now in the 2000s, when it's popular in the US, people are still saying it doesn't exist, but for very different reasons.
Yeah.
So I really felt like an odd fit there. And then, of course, coming here and having the music I like, but being American, mm-hmm. I don't really fit with the ethics in certain ways. Like, I don't have this whole obsession with social class. Mm-hmm. And I also have certain opportunities because I have an American accent. People don't immediately put me in a social class.
Sure.
So I have tremendous access to people who are interested in this music from all walks of life. And they don't necessarily see me as the enemy. They think that I'm probably dense because, I don't know, they... A lot of people tend to think Americans are dense, but I did not vote for George Bush. So I don't really think I'm that indie. And I love a lot of mainstream pop music. The stuff I like listening to in my car, well, this last week, it was just Hall & Oates.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
Smooth music.
There's nothing wrong with it. But again, it's like... I think that to be able to really study something, you have to have your foot inside and outside. So I do still see myself as both in and outside of that world.
Well, look, we hope that has shed some light on a few dark corners of the music world. But if it suddenly made you think of something you want answering, Wendy continues to answer your questions on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicblog, all one word. Okay, well, that's it for this week. Thanks again to Wendy. Thank you for coming in. You've elevated the level of discussion on this show by about 3 million percent. It's absolutely remarkable. And thank you, Tim. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
We're back next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.